Hi there, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. We're here to have conversations about living with spinal muscular atrophy. Throughout this podcast, we will be covering lots of different topics, from preparing for university, getting the most from your personal budget, sex and relationships, and lots more. So we invite different hosts from across the SMA community to come together here. We want to answer your questions, provide you with useful tips and recommendations, and also share personal stories. So please do reach out and connect with us here at the charity SMA UK. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find the podcast useful.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. This is episode 2 on home adaptations. My name is Josh Wintersgill, and today's episode we will be talking to Julian Fiorentini about his personal journey from boarding school to living in a care home and getting some useful tips on making adaptations to your home. Originally, this was going to be made as a single podcast, but because we've covered so much amazing content for you guys, it's going to be separated out into 2 podcasts. And the third one will be covering the rental side of things, which covers my experience about trying to find rented accommodation in the UK. So I hope you enjoy this podcast and what Julian has to say.
If I hand over to Julian to start, to sort of introduce yourself, Julian, and what sort of challenges or benefits you've had or achievements around housing and adaptations.
Okay, well, I'm Julian Fiorentini. I'm an older person with SMA. I'm not old, though. I hasten to add. And my earliest memory of housing adaptations actually is my granddad turning up somewhere with a barrow full of concrete and putting down a ramp to the back door of the house where we lived. And that was really kind of the first, you know, being told not to step in it, not to drive over it, and keeping the dogs off it. And then that was my first ramp, you know, basically a big lump of concrete. And that was kind of what it was like for quite a long time, really. As time's gone by, there's been better sources of adaptation. So I lived with my mum for a while after kind of leaving school. And that was very basic. I mean, when I think back on that now, I couldn't even open the front door to get out if there was a fire. You know, I couldn't use the loo on my own or anything. It was pretty kind of a nightmare scenario now if you think about that. Unfortunately, quite a lot of people are still actually having to go through that. There's just not enough housing out there to go around, accessible housing, that is. If I could touch on, I mean, kind of how I started, really. As I said, I lived with my mum and then I eventually didn't have anywhere to go. I was 17 when I left college, and I wasn't allowed to move in on my own because I wasn't homeless. So I couldn't get an accessible house then, even though I didn't want to go home. You know, I'd kind of been at boarding school for 5 years. I felt I was probably going to be okay. And but I couldn't get in at all anywhere anymore. I'm not sure if that's changed now, but I suspect not, to be honest, at that young age. And then by the time I left my mum's house, I had to go and live in basically a care home. Luckily, it was a care home with younger people. All of them, apart from about 3, had some form of neuromuscular disease. I think I was the only one with SMA, but there was a lot of people with different kinds of muscular dystrophy and a few people with other odd outlying things. But we were all young, so it was not so bad, but it was still a care home and I hated it. And that gave me the impetus, I suppose, to really push hard to make sure that I could get somewhere else. And I had a social worker that helped me. And although it took 4.5 years from going in there, I managed to get my own flat from my local council. So basically I moved somewhere else, another town, and where I knew no one, spent 4.5 years there, getting to know the place, and then I had to move all the way back to not quite where I was from originally either, so I didn't know anyone there, because that was the council I was under, so that was the only way I could get housing there.
I think it's really interesting, though, to think, how many years ago are we talking now, Julian, this was?
It's about...
30 years?
About 30 years ago, yeah.
So, to think just, you know, 30 years ago, yes, it's a reasonable amount of time, but in the grand scheme of things, the DDA's only been around, what, 25 years?
Yeah. So
I think that, you know, that's been in place for 25 years, and we're still seeing similar sort of problems. And actually, I read a book on... it was written by Francis Ryan, the Crippled book. And there was an interesting piece in there that it seems that more younger people now, because of housing, are being forced back into the care setting, because some local authorities are seeing it as a cheaper solution rather than paying for somebody to have a fully adapted home and have 24/7 care support at home. They'd just rather put them into, you know, a care home, or, you know, reverting back to, you know, what you were experiencing when you were a child. So it almost seems that even with things like...
Most of those figures, though, aren't actually that real. They're just based on kind of now rather than long-termism. If you work out those figures, because the Disabled People's Movement, as was, had these arguments 30 and 40, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Right. It isn't cheaper to keep people in a care home rather than out in the community. All these figures have been poured over. It just isn't. It might be cheaper to do it this year, but if you look over a longer span, you know, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, it's not cheaper to do that. You know, eventually people in the community become productive. They provide jobs for other people as well. And it's just a better environment for them to be in. So it's all we're having to have those arguments again.
But in terms of when you first start, when you moved into this property, your own, that took 4.5 years, what was that property like? What did you have at the time when you moved in, or what didn't work well?
It was an existing 2-bedroom flat in one of those kind of 3-story, 9-to-a-side council blocks that they built, in the kind of 60s, 70s and 80s. They're all kind of concrete, you know, pick how many rooms you want, sir, kind of council blocks. They're all the same. Probably a better size than the ones that you get now, which are, I think, considerably smaller. But for instance, I needed 2 bedrooms because I needed overnight care. But they couldn't make the existing bathroom suitable. So they made one of the bedrooms into my bathroom. But if you can imagine how small the original bathroom was, they made that into a bedroom, and it was the single most unlivable space. If anybody had to do anything other than sleep on it, and to be honest, they had to be quite a small person to do that. Even the size of the bed that could go in there was quite bad. It was quite an interesting challenge. The bits for me were okay. They were basic. You know, we had no overhead hoists. That wasn't a common thing to fit. They did knock a door in the wall so I could go sort of from my bed to the bathroom area. Had a hole under the bath, which is where I came across the whole, you can put holes under your bath thing to use a mobile hoist. And that actually works. And I still do that now, funny enough. You don't have to have the whole bath uncovered so it looks really horrible. You know, you could just have 2 strategic holes where the feet go, and that can work quite well. But they did all the kitchen for me so I could cook and help as well. Although, you know, like most people, I probably don't really like washing up very much, but that's probably the only thing I didn't do. So I did kind of learn to look after myself reasonably well. Not that I hadn't already before that, really. And it was good. It was a really nice form of freedom. I got direct payments and independent living fund, as it was called then, to employ my own staff. And people came in and out and helped me with my personal care, and I kind of lived my life that way. at some point, I think I was there for about another 5 years, and then at some point that became somewhere we couldn't live anymore. My partner had qualified from university, got a job somewhere else, and we needed to move, so we moved. And to do that, we literally had to buy a house, which was quite difficult because I didn't have any income at the time, and she had the very basic, basic salary.
So were you forced to move out because of your partner income?
Well, no, because of where my partner was working. So she works.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So she works in a specialized field of speech therapy. And she got a job, 50 miles away from where we lived.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really any other jobs anywhere nearer.
Yeah.
So we needed to move so that, she could conceivably commute to work, really.
Okay, so talk us through a little bit about that then, in terms of, finding a house that you wanted to live in, then obviously, 2, purchasing the property, 3, then having presumably some money that you could use to sort of make adaptations, or, how did you access the government funding to maybe do some of those adaptations for you within the property?
That's a very interesting thing. Actually, I couldn't access any funding to do any of that at all. Because you have to live in an area to claim funding from the area. And I, at the time, it was, I think you had to live somewhere for a year before you could actually claim any funding for it. So I couldn't really move anywhere where I couldn't use the toilet, use the bath, or go to bed, or in most cases, get in the front door. So we actually literally had to, we exhausted rental opportunities very quickly. There just weren't any. And I know that's an area that you're going to talk about in a little while. So we ended up literally having to borrow money and buy a house. And then within that money, we had to buy a house not as good as we could have afforded, because we had to use, a fifth of our budget to do it up. So we had to buy a 3-bedroom bungalow instead of a 1-bedroom flat or whatever, or a 2-bedroom bungalow, because we had to turn one of the bedrooms into a bathroom. And it was all a bit peculiar, really. And it was quite stressful for quite a long time. And I had to live in the council flat for about 4 months while a private builder did the work. And then we moved in. We had to get a mortgage on quite punitive rates because it was quite difficult. You couldn't take benefits into account for most of them, and there was loads of different issues. So that was quite a millstone around our necks for quite a few years, to be honest.
So are you saying that you took out a higher mortgage that include for more money so that you could use that money to make the adaptations that you required, essentially?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. Yeah. We needed, well, I suppose what it was, you can't do that because you can't spend the mortgage on something that's not a house. So you spend the mortgage on a house and you put less of a deposit down.
Yes.
Which gives you then higher interest rates to pay, which means that you end up owing more money, if that makes more sense.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah, so, but effectively, yeah, we borrowed more money than we needed to because we had to use the money to make some adaptations. Our adaptations were relatively simple. I think we changed the front porch, which was, it had a side door, and we just basically beat a hole in the front and put our front door on and filled the side door in so I could go straight in the house and build a ramp up to it. And we widened one doorway that I just couldn't make the turn and put a doorway through to a bathroom we built in the middle bedroom, if you see what I mean.
So
there was, if you think of 3 rooms next to each other, one of them ended up becoming the bathroom. And that's pretty much all that we did structurally to the house. And then there were a few other bits and bobs, like putting a ramp on the back door, which was lower than the, you know, the garden was lower. It wasn't really a garden, it was more like a postage stamp, but it was outside anyway. So you had to put those kind of things in. So we got those bricks in because they were quite long. But as for whether you need to move into an area, I think if you're buying a house and you're after a DFG, I think those rules still do exist. We'd need to check that. But I think those rules still do exist.
I think it's useful to check, not just for me, but for other people out there, you know, as they grow older, or parents that have children that might need to move because, you know, their partner may have had a change in job, and that, like, exactly like you, and you've got to move. So I think it's important.
I mean, housing associations are much more prevalent now than they used to be. When I was younger, you got a house from the council, where I live, certainly. There wasn't really a lot of other alternative providers of housing. So within housing associations, it might be possible to change boundaries. You know, if you can find somebody that wants to swap a similar kind of property, I think that's possible.
But my point there is that you're still bound by being under the local authority, and within their housing association, you're still bound by their terms as to whether or not it's feasibly practical for you to move to another area if you don't have the money to go privately.
That's true. And a lot of private landlords don't want their properties changed anyway.
If you're private, let's say you're under the local authority, so it's not a private landlord, you're in a council house and your job's changed and you're based in, I don't know, Liverpool, and now you've got to move down to London into another council property. Can that transition happen quite seamlessly if there's a change in job, or what hoops need to be jumped through in order to move?
I mean, I think the finding the property where you're going to go, that you can even start to make
an application
good, that's difficult. And that's really difficult for everyone, I think. You know, there's just not enough basic housing stock of any kind that is even vaguely accessible.
No, I think one of the other places that people could start, particularly if they're looking to buy, might be actually to go to some of these property developers that are putting up brand new builds in estates all over the country, and going and approaching them and saying, look, we want to potentially buy a house, but we need certain accessibility requirements for the house, and we'd like it designed in this way to make it more feasible for my requirements, then I'm sure they would be happy to facilitate a conversation, because ultimately they're still going to get paid for their work.
But yeah, if you pay, you can get, you're more likely to be able to get what you want.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that you'll be able to, for instance, claim a disabled facilities grant somewhere that you don't live. So if you wanted to move from Liverpool to London, I don't think you could claim a DFG, a disabled facilities grant, in London to undertake that work. So you'd still have to fund it yourself.
And even if
you did, it's only £30,000, which sounds like a lot of money, but there's a whole building industry around. I mean, I don't know if you can see behind me, there's bits of wallpaper hanging off and a thing around my door. I've just had the doors wiped in my house. And it's been 3 months to do a job that, you know, should have taken about 2 weeks. And they still haven't finished, and they still haven't sent a decorator yet. And they're supposed to make it, you know, look like what it was beforehand. It's not a complicated job. There was not a massive amount of anything to do.
And this has been funded by who?
This has been funded by a disabled facilities grant through my local council. It's the first time I've ever qualified, because prior to now, I had always worked. I had always qualified for a disabled facilities grant, but basically it meant I had to, because my job was reasonably well paid, I had to pay so much, I might as well have just paid for it anyway and not ask for a grant. So.
And I think that opens up a whole other discussion and can of worms, whereby we as a community are almost being restricted by our incentive to go and work hard, to earn good salaries, to then have to, you know, bear the brunt of all of the costs. Whereas if we weren't earning that salary, we could get it done. And I just think that, you know, we're almost being suppressed, because financially, once you then start having to contribute to some of these adaptations, it costs so much money that it almost becomes impossible to finance, because, you know, even though you could be on a higher salary, it's still not enough to compete with the costs of some of these adaptations. And I just think that, you know, unless you're filthy rich, being that middle income family on relatively good salaries, you might as well just be on a low income and get and apply for the support. In my eyes, at the moment, it's very difficult.
As long as it doesn't cost more than 30,000, because then they can't pay for it anyway.
I think it's certainly for maybe the younger generation that are maybe planning out their career, maybe going to university, looking at how can I become independent and move away from my family and have my own house and work. It is a big area and it's a grey area.
I don't think it's any easier than it was for me 30, 40 years ago.
What you're saying is that actually nothing's really changed too much. You know, we still got, okay, we might be more independent, but in terms of the barriers that are up for us to knock down to in order to be independent are still there, and it's still just as hard. I think that's what we're saying. What I'd like to do is just briefly go through all the different types of adaptations that can be done. You know, important ones, and then look at, you know, ways in which people can be creative at the moment with technology. I know there's a standard provision that you can get through the local authorities that is kind of, let's say they're maybe not as sophisticated solutions that you could necessarily buy yourself online with like Alexa and stuff like that. But maybe let's just talk, Julian, about the basic important adaptations and then go into the technology side of stuff.
I mean, one of my, you know, I suppose if you look at your top 10, maybe top five actually, adaptations that you need to be able to get in the front door. Which usually, not so much with modern housing, because there's a requirement that unless the area is especially against it, you know, like if it's a very hilly area or something like that, generally speaking, modern housing's a little bit flatter at the front than old housing. But for my house, it's got three massive doorsteps. So I've got a modular ramp system at the front of my house.
Like a zigzag.
It's not quite a zigzag. It's an L shape on mine.
Okay.
But it kind of goes round the car, and then it disappears out near the sort of the front of the house, and that's just to get the legally allowable 1-in-2 gradient. It's quite interesting. Those are usually quite easily available. The councils have a stock of them usually, because they can take them out and move them from different houses when they're not needed. Some of them are hideous to look at. They look like scaffold poles with bits of wood. And some of them are much nicer to look at, if you can call a ramp nice.
It's interesting. It all goes back to, you know, councils pay for convenience, don't they, and things that are quick and easy to put up. And it's not very much focused on inclusive design. It's very much just about doing the job and not really thinking about how people might feel or perceive that to be. And I think it's really important that, you know, when you're looking at houses, that you look at maybe the front of the house, and would you be willing to put up with something like that outside of your house? Because if not, then maybe you need to look at maybe another property. You know, there's all these things that you need to weigh up. So I think the ramp is definitely an important one. And I know at my house, or my old house, we had a zigzag shape ramp, and it didn't look too bad in the end. It didn't look too bad. But so that's number one.
Well, the next bit is, can you get through the door? So I have a door opener, which has been my number one best buy ever, I think. I mean, my first one kind of finally blew out about three houses down the line, and I could literally just get an electrician to come and plumb it in and somebody to screw it above the door. and it would work on most doorways and houses. And that's usually just an electric box with an arm, and you have an electric latch as well, and it kind of synchronizes the two, so it undoes the latch. Otherwise, it's a normal door lock, and it works very well.
And where did you have your button located, Julian? Because obviously,
I've got my button near my elbow, so you can probably see where my elbow sticks out. And I actually literally swing the backside of my chair around, a la that.
Yeah.
And my arm hits the button on the door.
Oh, really?
I've also, as you know, I'm a bit of a tech geek, so yeah. I've also plumbed in my own switches, so that it works on a voice command from me, either outside via my telephone or inside via speaking to some kind of Amazon Alexa or Google device.
Okay, so let's explore that a little bit then. As we're on the door piece, in terms of these switches, how what have you been able to do in order to make that work for you? How have you managed to?
Well, you can get some. It's basic switching. That is Wi-Fi enabled, and you get what do they call it? They call them skills for the Amazon devices, and you get one that's Amazon Alexa compatible. And if you know what you're doing, you can plumb it into the electrics for the door switch work, yeah. And that will then make it open and close. On a voice
and
command.
Are you aware of any organization that can actually do that for people at the moment?
No, I'm not. I had to investigate it for myself and figure out how to do it.
Commercialization opportunity, Julia. Come on.
That's true. But that's kind of part of what I do now. That's part of my self-given job, if you like, my consultancy role, is I can help people to do things like that by figuring out solutions in technology that already exists. So I'm not an inventor. I just find a way of enabling existing technology to work better for other people.
Well, it's an enhancement. You know, it's not, yeah, you're right. It's not necessarily inventing something. It's reconfiguring or enhancing to do something different that technology wasn't necessarily designed together to do.
Yeah, and my back door's got a power door opener that the council fitted, but they wouldn't fit one that was Wi-Fi capable or had long range. Okay. I think there's been some social things, maybe something's happened where people have opened the doors from the outside or whatever, I'm not sure. Yeah. But anyway, I've designed mine to work with a little robot. Which I can again talk to, and that opens the back door for me.
Yeah, so I think it's important for people to understand that getting these open, you know, these automatic door system entry systems, can be done, but through the local authority, relatively straightforward.
Yeah, and relatively cheaply for this kind of thing as well.
Yeah, it's actually a couple of grand, I think.
Or even less, depending on how sophisticated your door is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's important that people understand that it's fundamental to have this on, you know, regardless if you've got a child or you're a teenager and you know you're always with your parents, just because they're there, they can open the door for you. That's the wrong attitude. You need to be able to have your own independence to be able to open and close that door, because if your parents are out and you need to get out of the house.
Yeah, it's a vitally important safety thing. More than anything else,
and I think that's,
socially it's great, but fundamentally it's a very, very important safety issue.
Yeah, and I think that's when you batten that card back to the councils, they are very much all over it very quickly when you start talking about this safety, issue. They normally get it rectified pretty quick. But I think there's a couple of things here. So people could either have a remote control with a button on it.
Yep.
You might be able to put on your key ring or...
I've also got one of those, and that's what it came with, yeah. So.
Yeah. Could people get this button attached to their wheelchair?
Yep.
You've done that with your elbow, right? So how have you...
I've attached it to the wall in my hallway, so it's near the door.
So you hit that button in the hallway with your elbow when you turn the chair out.
Yeah, because you don't really want to be able to open the door if you can't see who's there.
Got you.
But
what about when you're trying to get in?
Pardon?
What about when you're trying to get in the house?
I use a shortcut from my phone and a voice command.
So if people don't have that,
yep,
and they want to be able to access that coming in through,
they will have a remote key fob, yeah.
Yeah.
So they'll need to be able to reach a button and push it.
Exactly. And that's my point, because there are some people out there with SMA type 2 and maybe, you know, that want to be able to use that, but yep, they can't access the button because of their strength.
You can get proximity keys now as well. So it's like an encrypted coded key. So yep, we've all been in, well, some of us have been in offices where you can't get through doors unless you've got a special key fob.
Yeah.
Well, increasingly, those are now becoming proximity sensors. So you don't actually have to touch it to anything. You just have to get within X amount of distance. Yeah. Okay. And then it will do that. Of course, you know, there are safety issues with those kind of things. You know, anybody who's got one of those can walk up. I mean, I suppose that's the same as any other key, isn't it, really? Anybody who's got a key to a house can get it.
Okay. So I think we've done that one to death, I think. I mean, there's various options out there for people. It's relatively affordable to do, whether you want to do it yourself or go through the funding route.
Yep, yep. And the council will probably have a stock of these, and certainly a supplier that they use that do, you know, lots of them every year.
Okay, so that's that one. What about number three?
Number three? Well, number three would be to do with number twos, really.
Okay.
For me, that's going to the loo. I find it quite refreshing to be able to use the toilet, so that's one of those things. So I use a bath. I know a lot of people use a shower.
You use a bath, do you?
I do use a bath. Yeah.
Oh, mate, tell me more, please.
Well, I going back to my original flat, what I found was when they wouldn't give me an overhead hoist, they cut a slot under the bath, and they bought a bath that stood tall enough from the floor and was made of metal. Because yes, that's the other problem. If you have a plastic bath, they can break when the hoist hits it.
Yeah.
So if you get an old style, but they're not old fashioned, a metal and enamel bath, they don't break if a hoist bangs it, and they're okay. Perfectly safe, really.
Or would you not just get a bath that is standalone, that is high enough for you to get a hoist under?
Yeah, you can do that. You can, you know, you can put anything under bath legs, can't you, to make it fixed? And
yeah,
and then you fix it usually to the wall, but I understand that there's a more a thing of fitting baths in the middle of the room. I guess it depends what you want to do and where you want to put your bath.
That's a bigger space you've got as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can even get sit-up baths with doors in the sides, although I never fundamentally trusted those, just because, you know.
That feel a bit weird.
If I'm sat up, then I might as well be in a shower, if you see what I mean. Yeah. For me, but that's personal choice, I guess. I got a fairly large bath to fit my fairly large body, and I have two strategically placed holes under the side where my mobile hoist can go in, and I clear the top of the bath and just get dropped into the bath.
And do you presume when you get, not, it's not too personal, but in terms of when you're getting into the bath, you take your sling out, do you, and then you can,
well, I tend to not bother anymore. I used to, but now it's soaking wet anyway, so I don't really see the point, so I just leave it in there.
Right, okay.
And all you have to do is just to make sure that all the straps and everything are in the right place when you come out again. Otherwise, that can be rather painful.
Oh, yeah, against skin. Yeah, that can't be very nice.
Well, it's not really my skin that I'm worried about too much, if you see what I'm saying.
I get understood.
But I would imagine that kind of issue is the biggest reason that people... I mean, the council certainly recommended to me that I get a shower chair and a wheel-in shower, and I get hoisted to the chair, wheeled into the shower.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That's what I have to do. But in some respects, it's a lot of faff as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel that I get clean that way, but then other people think, you know, you're making a person stew if you sit in a bath. So, one half dozen the other.
No, you're absolutely right. And I've been having this conversation with my nan since we've been in lockdown, because I've been temporarily living here just for COVID. And I've been having bed baths, and I have never had better cleans than having a bed bath. And it's because when you're sat on the chair, you can't get into the groin properly. You can't do under your bum and the back of your legs properly. Then you get dry skin, it gets itchy, and it's a pain in the arse. Literally.
Yeah, quite literally. And those are all the bits, if you use a wheelchair, that are kind of probably going to get the dirtiest.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
And presumably, when you're in the bath, do you get any, do you get pressure relief under your bum and your back when you're in the bath as well?
Yeah, you can float.
And again, there's another advantage to that, because you could potentially do stretches in the bath a little bit with the legs that you can't necessarily do on a shower chair. You could have better, you know, hygiene in terms of cleaning in a bath. In what's standing out to me, though, is a lot of probably why councils recommend you have a shower chair and a wet room is probably because it's easier for the carers. Because presumably if you've got a bath that's low and they're having to clean you, they're having to bend over. So is your bath raised or elevated?
No, mine isn't. But it's not as low as some baths, obviously, because of the hoist clearance issue. Oh, there's the dog.
Hello.
Nibs, settle down. Oh, he's going out again now. That's it. He just came in to make sure I was still here. Yeah, but you can get elevating baths that actually do lift right up.
So,
and I don't think that's a big deal either, really. I'm not sure how much they cost, though.
Just one thing for people to consider if they do that, they need to ensure that if they are using a portable hoist, height clearance is going to be an issue. So it's probably more beneficial for you to have a ceiling hoist in the bathroom if you're going to opt for a bath. It probably makes things a little bit simpler.
Yeah, I would say that's probably very true. And if I could physically do that in my house, i.e. my house would enable that, I probably would. But my house won't. So that's why I do it the other way. But yeah, I would say a ceiling track hoist would be better, easier for most things. Although not necessarily a reliability. I think manually pumped hoists are probably the most reliable.
Okay, and so number three is what, baths?
Well, baths and toileting. So you also need a toilet you can get on and off.
Okay.
Preferably with one that you can wash your own bum.
Yeah.
And if you can't get one of those toilets, you can buy add-ons that between sort of 30 and 50 quid.
Yeah.
You can actually fit under your existing toilet seat.
Yeah.
Or Japanese style toilet seats, which even heat up the water before it squirts your bottom.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's heaven.
They are the best things in the world, I think. They really are.
So there's a couple of things on the toilets that I just want to mention here. So you've got Closmat, which, you know, come with a spray that comes out and sprays your bum. And then it has a dryer, but the dryers are horrendous. They never clean your bum and you normally just need to have a wipe over to dry it. And then Closmats normally come with like a cable and a pad, and you just press the pad in. I'm sure you can get all different manner of buttons or pads that suit your needs. And you just push it and hold it in, and it does what it needs to do. Then in terms of the attachment that goes over the toilet, one thing to consider with those is they do the job, but they do raise the height of the toilet, which sometimes means that you may need a change of commode. So if you're rather than commode, it may mean that you might need a different shower chair. So if you're very comfortable with your existing shower chair, and you've got that worry of, oh my God, if I get this added topper, I'm going to need another one, then you might want to pursue sticking with maybe a Closmat or a standard toilet. But again, Closmats can also be slightly higher again as well. So you need to kind of weigh up, you know, there's lots of different things, comfortability with the shower chair versus toilet. But then, you know, normally every couple of years you change your shower chair anyway. So in some cases you might just want to bite the bullet. And then the Japanese toilets, I've not personally seen them. I've only ever seen the Closmat and the extra bit that you can put on top of the toilet.
I've got one that fits just under the toilet seat that only raises it maybe a centimeter.
Oh, is that it?
And you add a water feed. The big downside to it is it's only cold water feed. So you have to be quite hardy. But it does. Yes, basically.
Oh, I shouldn't have said that. That was.
I don't know. Person up, probably. Person up, yeah. And then, that can be quite chilly at times, but still does the same job. And that is just, it's just a little twist button. I can't actually do it myself, but as I can't actually get on the loo myself, there's going to be somebody around to turn that button. The biggest problem I found is with all of those, and including Closomat and all of those things, you can't usually aim the squirty bit. So if you don't sit square on the loo, which some of us don't, you have to
kind of move.
You have to know exactly where it's going to spray for it to do its job.
Yeah, and there's nothing worse than trying to get someone to test it. When I was at when I was at university, we had loads of people around, and I had a Closomat toilet in my bathroom, and we were all having a few to drink, and one of the folk from the flat next door had come in, and it was in freshers, and so we're all relatively new. And he said, "Josh, can I use your toilet?" And he had a couple of beers, and he went in, and on the toilet you have two buttons. One on the right is the flush, and then the other one is for a carrot. Well, not a carrot to push, but it basically operates the same way as the pad. So he pressed and held it, and he was looking at the toilet, and he just sees this arm come out underneath the toilet and got him completely soaked. And come running into the bathroom, and he goes, "What the bloody hell is that in your bathroom?" Because I'm soaked, and he was just dripping. And I tell you what, that was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It was so good. So if you do have a Closomat toilet,
be aware it's a minefield for other people.
Exactly.
So yeah, I would have liked to have seen that. That would have made me laugh a lot.
I'll tell you, could you imagine if TikTok existed when I was at university, mate, I'd be a millionaire now. The amount of money I'd get off of that video alone would be phenomenal. That would pay for me adapted house, that would.
Yeah, it definitely would. Four is sleeping. Bed. Yes. You've got to be able to sleep. And me, I like a nice big comfortable bed. My partner also values the fact that I have a bed that goes up and down in the air. It's a double bed, so we can both sleep in the same bed, but it does actually rise. There goes the dog again. So automatic beds, they can be quite expensive. I don't know if you can get double beds via your grant or not. I have to be honest.
I've had a look at it. Maybe not through the grant, but I know the local authorities will only provide me a single bed.
Yeah.
You can't get a double bed. So more often than not, you do have to go private for that sort of stuff.
I found a nice company that allowed me to pay for it over a couple of years, actually.
Okay.
And they did a private finance thing. It's been a great bed. And obviously my legs go up in the air as well, which is great in the summer. If you sit in a chair, you get edema issues and your feet get sweaty and they swell up and they hurt. So it's really good to be able to lie down and put your feet higher than your heart. And that's really nice. And also it's obviously got the up and down at the top bit, so it can help with sitting up. And I actually tend to sleep on a slight angle as well. I find that quite comfortable.
So you tilt the bed forwards or backwards?
I usually I kind of juggle it during the night depending on which position I'm in. So I sleep slightly leaned up. Not too far, but just a little bit. It seems to be more comfortable for me now.
Okay.
I've been in a wheelchair for a long time, so I'm kind of more wheelchair shaped than anything else.
Yeah. So then we've got beds are obviously an important one, making sure that you've got an electric bed with a rise and fall for your carers.
Yep.
And if you can get beds funded through the local authority, normally for nothing. But if you want that extra luxury, if you've got a partner or that extra space, then you do often have to go private. One recommendation that I would make is that always try to consider, if you are buying these bigger beds, that you always make sure the bed has clearance. So if you are using a ceiling hoist and your ceiling hoist breaks, you've always got a backup of being able to use a mobile hoist that is able to go under your bed.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot of those rise and fall beds are divan, and they go all the way to the floor, and you can't put a hoist under those.
Yeah,
that is a problem, yeah, so that's a very good point, yeah.
Number five, what's number five top tip, Julian?
Ooh, number five top tip. Well, I think I'd probably have to say kitchen. For people who can still help prepare food, get around, reach the fridge, do the washing up, all those kind of things. So having your kitchen adapted is a very good thing. If you can't do those kind of things, then I would say what you need to do is, number five for me, as an essential, would be just your kind of your whole home, smart home environment, really. So you need to set yourself up with lots of devices that enable you to control the rest of the house, whether that's heating, whether that's lighting, whether that's TV, whether that's seeing who's at your front door, answering your front door, all those kind of things without, in ways that's the easiest for you.
So budget-wise, if somebody wanted to install a smart home with their heating, with their lighting, with the curtains, maybe with, connecting everything to your door as well, how much money is somebody talking to implement this sort of technology, to connect it with their phone? And is there anywhere, if they don't have money to do that they could go and get potentially charity money, or grant funding, really, from other sources to enable to implement the technology?
Honest answer, I don't think that there are many charities doing that kind of grant funding at the moment. How much would it cost? It depends how far you want to go. The actual items are not that expensive, and most of them can be bought. You used to have to get specialized computer systems fitted by specialists that would do all this stuff. Now you can buy most of the stuff from the internet that will work with your voice enabled system of choice, from Apple or Google or Amazon or and others potentially, but those are the ones that have the biggest kind of ecosystems, so the most amount of things that you can add into it, really. And those, really, even the most expensive item is probably not going to be more than a couple of £100, and that would be to do like your whole central heating system on the Wi-Fi, really.
Okay.
I mean, your phone that you're controlling it with is probably going to cost more than most of these bits of kit.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that's good. So there we are. We have Julian's top five tips. So hopefully they are useful.
You've been listening to the Living with SMA podcast. We hope you can join us again next time. But in the meantime, please don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find out more on our website at smauk.org.uk.